Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 200. Yes, we've reached the double century milestone on this winding journey through the past. When I began this series a couple of years ago, after many years of planning, I had no idea what would happen. Diving into the shark tank that is history podcasting took a great deal of forethought. One person's history, as we know, is another person's propaganda. Social engineers rewrite the past to suit their own agendas, and I've tried to deliver this series on the basis of our people's stories first, endeavouring to let the folks of the South talk for themselves, which of course can threaten many folks' worldview about their origins, their own personal narrative. It's rife with risk. So it's with some relief to report that the response has been overwhelmingly positive. This series is now the third most shared podcast in South Africa. A stunning revelation, given that I'm doing this solo. There's no marketing team, no financier, no patron, just you and me. Thanks to Francois, by the way, at iona.fm for the growth in advertising. Nothing for Mahala, I guess. Speaking of filthy lucre, I have a PayPal account for donations. It can be found on desmondlatham.blog. The funds go towards the series' audio hosting fees. And on YouTube, I'm beginning a series of videos there too. With that craven bit of begging, let us continue, for we are going to spend this episode meeting Cape Governor Sir George Grey. He's probably the most influential Englishman in both New Zealand and South Africa's history, playing a role in the annexation of Maori land. He spent time also as a governor of Australia, very much an administrator of his time. He believed in educating the masses, and he did put his money where his mouth was. He founded Grey's College in Bloemfontein in 1855, then Grey's High School in Klabega a year later. In between, all manner of shenanigans were recorded. But wait, as we hear about Sir George, I'll introduce his amaxhosa alter ego, Mantlakaza, otherwise known as Wilhelm Goliath, who was the first amaxhosa Anglican in South Africa. Mantlakaza's relationship with the Archdeacon of Grahamstown, Nathaniel James Merriman, was going to change the whole course of South Africa's history. Don't take my word for it. This is the view of many who know much more about this than me, particularly the fantastic historian Jeff Perris. So here were two people, two opposites, Grey and Goliath. Their tale is tantamount to the gears of history turning like a great soot-streaked clockwork, steampunk cogs groaning under the weight of human ambition and magical ether, while the past, a fog of coal smoke and brass, hisses and sputters, propelling the unwieldy engine unsteadily into the unknown. Sir George Grey had a somewhat perfunctory introduction into the world when his mother was sitting on a Lisbon hotel veranda in 1812, overheard two soldiers talking about the death of her husband, George Grey Sr. The shock caused her to go into labour. Senior Grey had died fighting in the Spanish Peninsula, so the young George, who survived this premature birth, had a somewhat spectacular introduction to the crazy little thing called life. His mother did not remain a widow for very long, remarrying a clergyman from Bodiam, which is a small town next door to Sandhurst Military College, and that is where young George was schooled. Upon completion of his studies, he was dispatched as a gentleman officer to Ireland at age 17, where he was involved in suppressing the various Irish uprisings for the next 6 years. It is here in Ireland that he began to form ideas about how colonialism should work. Emigration, he believed, was the solution to Great Britain's problems. There was not enough land. The working class needed avenues of escape, and escape to the colonies was a preferred route rather than into the cesspools of industrialized cities of Europe. He was steeped in the tradition of Anglican liberalism, which holds that education is the key to development for all races. Young George naturally turned his attention to the Southern Hemisphere. Here lay excitement and opportunity. In Grey's case, this wasn't just some political hype. The bloke took off in 1836 on a series of expeditions, fact-finding missions, you could call them, with full backing of the Colonial Office. George's first trip was to the far corner of northwestern Australia. The landing was not a success. On the first day, most of his men collapsed from heat stroke. Then they ran out of water. Then they were attacked by local aborigines. No one was injured or died in the fracas, but it was a rude awakening. 14 days later, George was cornered by a group of Aborigines who stabbed him 3 times in the hip. He managed to get away, but was seriously injured and now far from any help. An abscess formed, and the agony drove him to self-medicate with laudanum. This is an alcohol-based tincture, about 10% opium, or in other words, 1% pure morphine. Victorian-era women were prescribed laudanum for menstrual cramps, and infants were spoon-fed this stuff. Little did they know how habit-forming this drug was. There, back in the 19th century, stuffing opioids into themselves and their kids. Abraham Lincoln's wife, Mary Lincoln, was a laudanum addict. So too was the English poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge. It was cheaper than gin and wine. Everyone loved it, drinking it like there was no tomorrow. And when too much was drunk, there was no tomorrow. This flirting with opium / morphine was going to haunt young George in coming decades. The pain from his hip would last a lifetime, and so too the imbibing of laudanum. Some historians believe his extraordinary patterns of behaviour can be ascribed to opium intake. Little George survived his wound, but it left him with permanent pain. He returned home, then headed back to northwestern Australia 10 months later, a sucker for punishment. This time he landed on an island that was uninhabited by Aborigines because it really was dry. There wasn't a drop of water on it. After a month of shuttling between various islands, his men were starving and beyond dehydrated. Grey decided to sail south to Perth, but the wickedly powerful Indian Ocean drove all his boats onto a rocky shore, destroying them. They were now stranded 500 kilometres north of Perth. Despite his hip problem, Grey was fairly frisky, and in the long walk back to Perth, took off, leaving most of his men behind. They were going too slowly. He walked the 500 kilometres in 2 weeks, then returned by ship to pick up his abandoned men. Incredibly, only one had died. In true Sir George fashion, he turned these disasters into successes, passing himself off as an intrepid explorer and proceeded to name 10 rivers and 2 mountain ranges. He had repeatedly skirmished with the Aborigines throughout his meanderings. On the other hand, he'd collected vast numbers of unknown shrimp and shellfish, fish, butterflies, insects. Because he was a man of his time, he then published 2 excellent books called Journals of 2 Expeditions of Discovery in Northwestern Australia. He went on to become magistrate of the Albany District, no, not of the Eastern Cape, but of Western Australia. Marrying Lucy Spencer shortly afterwards, he applied his mind to how Aborigines should be governed. Here is where our new character, Sir George, was similar to Sir Harry Smith. George took issue with the concept that Indigenous people should be allowed to continue exercising their own customs in the face of colonialism, however well meant. Grey believed white and black people were essentially the same. It was only culture and backward rituals that separated the races. Grey wrote regularly about how Aborigines, the Maoris and later Amakosa, are as apt and intelligent as any other race of men I am acquainted with. They are subject to the same affections, appetites and passions as other men. Simply put, he thought that the Aborigines, the Maoris, the First Peoples of Canada, the Khoikhoi, the Nguni and Tswana all wanted to become Englishmen, but they couldn't because they were trapped by the barbarous customs and rituals enforced by their older generations. And yet, at the same time, the colonial in him believed that no Aborigine or Maori or African was worth the grand heights of English culture. Still, that didn't stop him personally conducting a major contribution study of the Maori language and folklore. This study is regarded as one of the most important researches into early Maori ways, a contradiction considering that he didn't hold the Maori ways in high regard. What a strange character. On one hand, he was espousing the English way, but on the other, saw the indigenous men and women as essentially the same as Europeans. He was not talking equality in an intellectual sense, but in a moral and human sense. He was what you'd call a liberal humanist, with a twist. Because he believed the Maori folklore he studied was puerile and their religion absurd. The only reason to study indigenous cultures, he said, was to communicate more effectively with their chiefs using this knowledge so that he could destroy what he regarded as barbarous ways. Savage customs, railed Grey, should be expunged. and in its place, English law be instituted. And how do you do that, I hear you ask? Well, answered George, through education. Native schools, as he called them, should be established, and Maoris could be used as skilled labourers to build public roads. They would be civilised through schooling and hard work. He was to bring that idea from the land of the long white cloud to South Africa. Gray's views were those of the utilitarian Victorian, driven by the evangelical Christian doctrine that human nature is intrinsically the same in all races and cultures. However, the utilitarians went a bit further. They believed that the rule of law and the power of government were the main steam-driven engines that empower social development, not the church. Ominously, we live in an era where this premise has been eclipsed by people like the American Christian nationalists. They are firmly of the belief that religion, or their warped version of it, should be the steam-driven engine that empowers social development instead of the rule of law and good government. Anyway, back to George. He wrote of how the London merchant with the wizard wand of commerce touches a lone and trackless forest, and at his bidding cities arise, and the hum and dust of trade collect. Commerce was part of the system of benefactors. The London merchants somehow elevated to a group of noble minds laying the foundation of the previous six great empires, who, together with her progeny, is overspreading the earth, not by sword, but by the gentle arts of peace and benefice. Of course, the gentle arts of peace and benefice carried a price for recalcitrant black people. These ancient races should be swept away, he said, by Anglo-Saxon civilization, and what he called their antique laws and customs would be assigned to oblivion. This is what sparked the Eighth Frontier War previously, and young prophet Nonkawuse would use Gray's words against him in coming years. The initial plan by British officials was to keep the indigenous customs separate from colonists' customs, but by 1840 that plan just unraveled. Separateness fails repeatedly in the real world. Segregation does not work. Trying to segregate the Albany district from the Amatola Mountains failed. The Boers in the Free State from Moshweshwe failed. The AmaZulu in Natal from the Boers and British failed. The social engineers of apartheid, of course, would try it again and fail. Or, to use the modern outcomes-based education terminology, they did not meet outcomes. Gray dismissed segregation, saying separating people only perpetuates suspicion, ignorance, and savagery, thereby exacerbating frontier warfare. Radical racial amalgamation is what was required, he said. Gray is certainly a curious George. He believed settlers and indigenes complemented each other as long as the indigenous people were educated and developed skills through training. After schmoozing high friends in places in England, the 28-year-old George Gray was installed as the governor of South Australia in 1841, where he began instituting his racial amalgamation policy. He was promoted to governor of New Zealand in 1845, continuing the trend, and promoted once more to governor of the Cape in 1854. Meanwhile, and unfortunately for those who came into contact with curious George Gray, he had developed a nasty little habit apart from his opium addiction. He was a prodigious liar. The first to feel the effect of his gargantuan fib-telling feats were the Maoris. It was under Gray's tenure that the Maoris lost control of 6 million acres of North Island, then later the entire South Island. In one of Gray's momentous acts, he tricked a powerful but neutral Maori chief called Te Roparaha into a meeting accusing him of conspiring to kill settlers and rape white women. It was true that Te Roparaha had been playing a double game, gun-running by selling muskets to Maori who were actually fighting the British. The chief was then trapped in his house, but it was the manner of the trapping. Gray ordered that he be grabbed by his testicles, which in Maori culture meant he had been insulted and lost prestige. Thus, Gray had weaponized his Maori folklore and culture knowledge he'd studied so well. That's how he managed to seize most of Maori land in the North Island, holding the chief ransom by his tender bits until Te Roparaha's followers had been weakened locally by the chief's public humiliation and vacated 3 million acres for British settlers immediately. Te Roparaha was freed, never to be made whole again. It was partly Grey's actions in New Zealand that were going to lead to a major war there in 1860, and one which is connected through its millenarianism to the cattle killing in the Cape. The Maoris realised that their only hope against colonisation was to stop their bitter internecine fighting, to unite behind a single king, and this whole idea was driven by a salvation message delivered by a converted Christian. Many, many resonances in time and place. We all connected. The Colonial Office of the 1850s believed Grey's outrageously self-serving reports. He bombarded London with hopelessly optimistic dispatches, glowing with egotistical hogwash. New Zealand historian Alan Ward said the effect of the flood of gushing dispatches compounded the purblind optimism and deliberate deceit, and led to the mistaken belief that the Maoris were satisfied with their lot and amalgamation was imminent. By amalgamation, Grey was deploying a specific form of political expression. Another way of thinking of his amalgamation policy was forced assimilation. Another New Zealand politician called him the artful dodger of governors. The Maoris said he was like a rat that burrowed underground, then popped up when least expected. He was a complex man. Grey was extremely well-read and gifted. He counted among his peers his friends, Charles Darwin, who needs no introduction, Charles Lyell, the Scot, whose principles of geology almost single-handedly changed how people viewed natural forces on Earth, and Thomas Carlyle, another Scot, who occupied a central position in Victorian culture as an essayist, a historian, philosopher. Grey's collection of books and journals was immense, now stored in Auckland Central Library. This collection includes rare books and medieval manuscripts, special highlights such as Roman Missal from the 15th century of Besançon, and Shakespeare's first folio, and the first music to God Defend New Zealand. A man of his time is perhaps too simple an approach. He arrived in South Africa shortly after the failure of English colonial policy in the Cape had become clear through the unprecedented cost of the Eighth Frontier War. Grey's main focus was what he called native civilization, and his ideas about race were informed by this liberal Anglican theology, mixed with personal experience, his gut feel, and topped off by scientific investigation, very Victorian. Combining science and social issues, a dialectic, was very much part of this period of history. Karl Marx emerged at this time for good reason. There was a propensity for the intellectuals of the mid-19th century to fixate on dialectic debate. In a nutshell, dialectic is a method of exploring ideas through reasoned dialogue. It's about examining opposing viewpoints to uncover deeper truths or resolve contradictions. It originates with philosophers like Socrates or Plato and later Hegel. It often involves a process of thesis, an idea, then antithesis, a conflicting idea, and then synthesis, a resolution that combines elements of both. Think of it as a conversation where ideas evolve, not through agreement, but through critical engagement, like two minds sharpening each other to get closer to the truth. Marx was a follower of Hegel's. Carlyle, Grey's friend, read Hegel. There is no doubt that Grey and Carlyle pinned their thinking on matters dialectic, and the thesis for Grey was racial amalgamation. Kiwi historian Susanna Grant has written quite a bit about Grey's racial amalgamation theme. As she points out, he grew in a complex mix of biblical enlightenment and early 19th century ideas of race, believing the Maoris, the Amaxhosa, the Khoikhoi, the AmaZulu, and so on, occupied a lower place in the scale of civilization than Europeans, but that all races were equal and capable of elevation. They could all progress together still further up the scale of civilization, the pinnacle of which had been scaled by Englishmen. This model formed the basis of Grey's 1840 plan for civilizing native peoples, in which he proposed a range of measures to promote amalgamation in Australia, New Zealand, South Africa. Grey's manufactured triumph in New Zealand convinced the Colonial Office that he could rescue the unstable Cape Colony. So when Grey arrived in South Africa in 1854, he found few sympathetic Xhosa chiefs, nothing like the Treaty of Waitangi back in New Zealand. Therefore, in the words of Perez, Grey applied his civilization policy with a rigour untempered by a sympathetic restraint. George Grey landed in Cape Town with the idea firmly embedded in his mind that he could uplift the lives of Africans through assimilation, civilizing all peoples by turning them into black Europeans, or more accurately, black Englishmen. By doing so, he believed he could turn irreclaimable foes into friends. Grey was determined to sort out the struggle for land on the frontier, the Eastern Cape and in the Free State. The public works programs he set in motion, in many ways, are still with us today. His focus on road building legendary, and his approach to Amaxhosa agriculture intriguing. The irrigation furrows he had built have lasted through to the 21st century, and you could say he finally stabilized water supply for many in the Eastern Cape and beyond. He did have the good fortune to arrive in the Cape as the standard of living rose. Grey was going to take a lot of flack, though, from settlers for purposefully intermingling the land of colonists and Amaxhosa. Next episode, we'll spend time with Sir George Grey as he began his administration and meet Wilhelm Goliath, real name Mantlakaza. He was Nonkwawusi's uncle, also the first Xhosa to become an Anglican, and Nonkwawusi was a teenager who was going to trigger a mass sacrifice of Xhosa cattle. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility. And you can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'm going to load an update about this episode. You can email me from there. Until next, goodbye.